Son, find a warm place. Smith bailed out of the jeep, passed through a pair of guards. Men far more miserable than he was pushed his way into the tent. The coffee came quickly now, the aides knowing exactly what he wanted. Sexton there, offering a can of pipe tobacco. Pulled this from the private stock. I saw you empty the last tin. A bit nippy out there, sir? Smith took the tobacco, sat, said, How cold is it? To one side, Bowser said, 30 below this morning, we think. Thermometer broke. Someone carried it in here just to show me, and the warmth in here just shattered it, I guess. Or Captain Sexton dropped it. I forget which. Smith sipped at the coffee, pulled the pipe from his pocket. Well, then, someone needs to find us another one. Bowser said, Already on it, sir. They making good progress on the airstrip? They're closer. It's usable. I keep thinking of General Almond handing out medals to anyone he bumps into. It's those boys out there, the engineers, who deserve one. Colonel Partridge told me they're taking turns holding off the enemy. One man drives the tractor, one shoots the carbine. I want the whole world to know what those boys are doing. Bowser went to the coffee pot, poured a cup for himself, said, You know, you don't have to go out there yourself. I've volunteered to do it, and I know full well any man here would rather eat this weather than watch you do it. It's no different than going up to Udomnee. I really don't understand why you won't send me up there. Smith lit the pipe, scanned the tent, the staff engulfed in all manner of work, paper, and radios. Because I want you here, and it's not up for discussion. What do we hear from Litzenberg? Bowser said, It wasn't too bad last night. Not nearly as many casualties. The enemy seems to have calmed down a bit. They could be regrouping, and Litz expects to be hit again, maybe tonight. He and Murray have their heads together, and they seem pretty pleased with your orders. Smith clamped the pipe in his teeth, thought, I suppose I should be grateful. Litzenberg argues with every order he gets. Now if they can just do the job. Any progress on opening the road this way? Not yet. He says the enemy is in strength all along the road, major roadblocks at several points. Air recon confirms that. Murray should have his people back into Udomnee by now, if the Chinese let them disengage. They had gotten a mile or more west of the town when they got hit. Weather was pretty stinky up that way earlier this morning, made things tough for the chopper pilots. The fighters are getting through, hitting the enemy positions when they can find them. You want to give out medals, give them to the air spotters. Litz says those boys have saved lives. The enemy wants no part of an air assault, and they button up good when the planes show up. What about Fox Company? Bowser seemed to hesitate. Not sure. The air boys say they're still on the hill, overlooking the road. We're dropping ammo, and we've supplied batteries for their radios. Bowser motioned to a man to one side, earphones clamped to the man's head. Sergeant, anything from Captain Barber? The radio man shook his head. No, sir. I'll try again. Bowser said, Try every half hour. He looked at Smith, who saw the worry. It could just be the weather, or these mountains. Barber's got to be trying to communicate with Udomnee or us. Let's give him every chance, sir. He knows what those batteries are for. Smith finished the coffee, stood, tried to ignore the pains in his legs. He appreciated what Bowser was doing, that no matter what else was needed, Smith had to keep his best staff officers close at hand. The priority still was Huggaroo Ree, and Bowser was as important to him as finding rifles to strengthen the perimeter. I'm going to my quarters. Let me know if Barber gets through. Let me know if we hear from Colonel Drysdale, or anything new from Litzenberg. Get on the horn to General Tunner at Air Force Cargo. Tell him we're close to a usable airstrip, and I want every plane in the Far East Command to be gassed up and ready. Well, no. Don't tell him that. Just let him know we are very close to asking him for all the help he can send this way. Outside, He heard the roar of a fighter formation passing low. Bowser glanced upward, said, "I'll try to reach General Harris. We get out of this place, the air wing will be one reason why. I'll buy him a steak dinner."
"I'll buy him two."
Smith paused. A new thought. "I suppose once we get the strip completed, we'll get a mail run." He saw the other faces turn, knew that mail was a magical word. Bowser said, "Yes, sir, I suppose so. The boys mention it once in a while." Smith slid into the coat again.
"I'll be in my billet. I'll be ready to send a few letters of my own. I want my wife to know I'm not just up here getting a suntan."
He moved outside quickly, the cold blasting him. He hobbled slightly, hoped no one noticed, stepped gingerly through the packed snow toward the small house. He glanced out from the hood of his coat, saw the nearest aid station, slowed his steps, couldn't avoid feeling a familiar gloom, asked himself, how many more were there today? At least I should look in on them. He passed a row of corpses draped in snow-covered cloth, slowed, counted 2 dozen. More tonight, he thought. No, let that go. We cannot fix this. Not yet. He looked toward the large tent, the tin chimney spitting out a column of gray smoke, swept away by the wind. Stepping carefully, he avoided a smear of ice, stepped to a layer of rice straw spread out, a pathway that led to the entrance of the tent. He stepped inside, a flurry of quiet activity, smells of disinfectant and urine. Too familiar. He eyed the doctors, stethoscopes and hypodermic needles, those men ignoring him. A handful of corpsmen were there as well, stepping over the closely packed cots, none of them empty. Smith scanned the wounded men, faces turning toward him, no one speaking. He wanted to give them something, to tell them of the airstrip, the promise that very soon they could be evacuated, a real bed in a real hospital. Another flight of corsairs flew over, answered by subdued cheers from the wounded men, one man raising a fist, his own silent salute. I can't add anything to that, he thought. They'll salute me when I give them a good reason. Right now, they don't have one. Behind him, litter bearers moved inside, a doctor coming forward with a bottle of plasma, giving instructions. We're ready. Lay him over here. The men obeyed, and Smith kept back, looked at the wounded man, the man's clothing coated with icy filth, black stains, one leg exposed, the man's skin white and frozen. The doctor went to work, one corpsman hanging the plasma beside the work table, the man's uniform cut away. Smith had seen this before, so often, in the Pacific, wounds festering quickly from the heat. But there was very little blood here, the wounds freezing, the one astonishing benefit of the absurdity of the weather. He saw now the wounded man was an officer, unfamiliar face, an army uniform. Staff, he thought, one of Almond's clerks, or a musician, maybe. He imagined the scene, the man receiving orders he never expected. Here's a rifle, son. Now you're going to fight. There's an enemy out there who doesn't care what your job is, what you were trained to do, and we don't care either. Right now, we don't have the luxury of soft duty. Can I help you, sir? He knew the face. The naval doctor, Eugene Herring. Herring had a wide smear of something awful on his apron, looked at Smith with dark, exhausted eyes. Smith focused on the man's face, heard a hint of hostility in his voice.
This will be over soon, doctor. The airstrip will be ready for transport planes in a day or two.
If you say so, sir. Please, excuse me. Herring turned away, moved to the work table, assisting the other doctor. Smith knew he was out of place here, could offer nothing to help these men do their work,
but he could not just leave, said aloud, "We will be out of here very soon. We are doing everything we can." No one responded, and Smith pulled the coat tightly around him, backed out of the tent. He stared down at the letter, reread, erased a word, made a correction, wrote again. Our clerks were out there with weapons. Our lines held. He slid the paper aside, thought, I cannot tell her more. I don't have to. She understands. She knows what I do and how it is done. She knows there is a cost. I should cry to her, sing sad songs. I won't give her that. It isn't a part of me. One day I will sit with her, and perhaps we will cry. But not now. It's like Dr. Herring. I offer him encouraging words, and he stares at me with a man's guts on his hands. How is he encouraged about that? All I can really give any of them is confidence. The men must see that, must always feel that from their commander. It is not enough for me to hope that we survive this. We must prevail here. No matter what the fools in Tokyo believe, no matter what they tell us to do, we will win this thing. I believe that, and so we will all believe it. We must believe it. Yes, our lines held. They will hold. And as God is my witness, I will do what must be done to protect these men, to repair the raw, ugly stupidity that sent us out here. Early that morning, another column of armor moved out on the road east of the reservoir, one more attempt to drive through the enemy's stranglehold on the isolated position of the Army's 31st Regimental Combat Team. A few miles northeast of the marine perimeter at Hagaru Ri, a dozen tanks, commanded by Army Captain Robert Drake, had held position at the small village of Hudong Ni, close to the shores of the reservoir. Drake's plan was to push the armored column through the Chinese roadblocks, blowing open a path of escape for the troops to withdraw back down to Hagaru Ri. The tanks were accompanied by some 36 infantry, some of those South Korean troops. But Drake's plan had two major problems. First, the tankers did not have their own forward air controller, and so he could not communicate with the air protection he had hoped for, even as the Corsairs patrolled the skies directly overhead. With no instructions where to place their fire, the Corsairs were partially blind and ultimately inflicted casualties on both sides. The second problem had more to do with the first effort General Hodes had made to rescue his troops. That column had lost 4 tanks, one of which completely blocked the only road Drake could use. Drake's alternative plan was to push his armor directly up the hill that guarded the passageway, which was heavily occupied by Chinese troops. But the tanks could not maneuver up the frozen slopes. Faced with a potential disaster to the column, Drake had no choice but to withdraw once more. A few miles to the north, the 31st's commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Don Faith, with no radio contact with the tanks or with anyone at Hagaru Ri, had no idea that anyone had made the effort to help the 2,800 men in his command. The only positive that resulted from Drake's mission was that now, with no reason to remain at the advance position at Hudong Ni, he ordered the tank column to pull back to the defensive lines at Hagaru Ri, adding to the forces there who had every reason to expect another nighttime attack. Just before 10 that morning, Colonel Douglas Drysdale led his 900-man task force northward out of Koto Ri. Almost immediately, Drysdale confronted the same obstacles that had faced the Americans along every part of the main road. The 11-mile journey to Hagaru Ri was sliced through by Chinese roadblocks, troop placements fortified by machine guns and mortars. Facing a far stronger enemy than he had anticipated, Drysdale radioed his situation back to Chesty Puller. Puller responded by ordering a company of nearly 30 tanks out of Koto Ri to add considerable firepower to Drysdale's column. Drysdale appreciated the advantages the tanks offered and ordered their commander to distribute the tanks in pairs all along the column. But the tank commander, Captain Bruce Clark, insisted the tanks remain together, a formidable force the Chinese could not hope to stop. Drysdale had no authority over Clark's command, and the tanks remained mostly clustered together, leading the way north. Clark's men soon engaged Chinese targets all along the route, and though most of the fights were one-sided in favor of the armor, the tanks' slow progress meant that the lengthy column of trucks behind them would move slowly as well. If the tanks were intimidating to the Chinese, not so the column in their wake. With the vulnerable vehicles spread out in a grindingly slow advance, the Chinese attacked the column in several locations, turning a single convoy into at least three separate parts. Frustrated with the slow progress of the tanks, Drysdale understood what was happening to his task force behind him. The most acceptable alternative seemed to be to withdraw and fight their way back to Koto Ri, but Oliver Smith had a very different view. Reaching Smith by radio, Drysdale explained his situation. Smith, still faced with the desperate need to bolster the defenses around Hagaru Ri, ordered Drysdale to push onward at all costs. Drysdale responded with typical British aplomb. "Very well, then. We'll give them a show." Late in the evening on November 29th, the vanguard of Task Force Drysdale reached the southern perimeter at Hagaru Ri. With Drysdale were most of the tanks, most of his Royal Marine Commandos, and the Company of American Marines. At the rear of the convoy, nearly a third of the column, including many of the trucks and supply vehicles, escaped the worst of the Chinese assaults and pulled back in a desperate escape to Koto Ri. But in the center, fully one-third of the task force could not move in either direction, and throughout one awful night were left to the mercy of the Chinese. Hagaru Ri, November 29th, 10 p.m. The tanks had inspired a raucous cheer, the men along the southern perimeter welcoming the added strength of the armor with a mix of joy and exhausted relief. The Marines were welcomed, too, Tom Ridge's George Company adding to the manpower that Ridge was still shifting into the most vulnerable positions all around the town. But the men at Hagaru Ri had seen these men and their heavy equipment before. What caused the most curiosity, a respectful salute, was the appearance of the Royal Marines. Their dress was different, of course, green berets worn instead of helmets. Those men stiffening, a show of perfect decorum as they marched past the men who welcomed them. None carried that decorum with more pride than their commander. Smith stood, Drysdale saluting him, and he stared at the Englishman for a long moment. Drysdale seemed uncertain now, as though he may have violated some kind of American protocol. "At your service, sir. It was a bit dicey. I very much regret that we could not advance the entire column. It is a rather dismal outcome, to be sure."
"Colonel, you were wounded."
Drysdale ignored the ripped shirt sleeve, the caked blood soaking through his uniform.
"Appears so, yes, sir. Not a problem. You have medical people here, yes? They should be able to fix me up. Good as new."
Smith glanced at Bowser, who kept his stare on Drysdale.
"Yes, by all means. My aide will escort you to the medical tent. You may report to me when you're up to it."
Drysdale seemed disappointed.
"Oh, sir, I'd rather lay out the details now, if you don't mind."
Smith couldn't avoid looking at the man's wounded arm.
"Are you quite certain you're up to it?"
Drysdale attempted a small laugh.
"Oh, I assure you, sir, I've endured much worse. Never run into an Oriental yet who could pull the starch from a British Marine?"
Smith thought, "Not the time for this sort of thing, but he seems to mean it."
"Very well, Colonel. I'm gravely concerned about the condition of your column. Colonel Puller radioed that some of the men and equipment returned to Koto Ri. I suppose we should be grateful for that."
"If you say so, sir. I regret that we could not maintain contact. The enemy was bloody eager to chop us to bits, and with most of the armor gathered in the vanguard, there was little to protect the soft vehicles. I would hope that those who did not accompany me here were successful in escaping the enemy's grasp. I suspect there were losses, sir. He paused, a crack showing in the stern demeanor. Considerable losses, I'm afraid. Smith had already received a ragged estimate from Puller, though no one yet could know just what was still happening along the narrow, winding road.
We will do what we can for anyone still out there, Colonel. My greater concern is right here. If Hagaru Ree falls into the enemy's hands, it will jeopardize the entire force we have employed to the north of here. How many men made it through with you?
Near 300, I'm happy to say.
I would be happier still if your entire force had reached here.
Drysdale seemed subdued now, said, Yes, of course. As would I, sir. I will bear the responsibility for our losses, General.
No, you won't. That responsibility falls upon me.
He looked again at Drysdale's wounds. When you are able, you will report to Colonel Ridge. He commands the perimeter here. We will make the best use of your men as we can, I assure you. I am grateful for your efforts.
The compliment rolled out of Smith with no enthusiasm, as though he were greeting the man at a formal dinner party. He was uncomfortable now, still eyed the man's arm.
Really, Colonel, I insist you go to the medical tent. Colonel Bowser, will you ask one of the aides to show him the way?
Certainly, sir.
Drysdale saluted Smith again, said,
I shan't be long, sir. I should see to my men, at least for the evening. They have had one devil of a day, as it were.
Smith returned the salute, motioned toward the door, Drysdale moving out with the young aide. Smith waited for Drysdale to leave, felt a chill, the stove not quite adequate to heat both rooms. Bowser stood out in the larger room, said,
He dripped blood all over the place.
I'll have it cleaned up, sir.
Let it go, Alpha.
Smith pulled the pipe from his shirt pocket.
What do you make of that fellow?
He's British, no doubt about that. He'd rather pass out from loss of blood than admit he might be in pain. We colonists should never observe such weakness in one of His Majesty's troops.
Smith had no use for the kind of rivalries that always seemed to rise up.
It was a very bad day, Colonel. Louis says he counted 300 men who made it back to Koto Ree. 300 made it here. Nothing complicated about the math. 300 men are either dead or grabbed by the Chinese. All of that stiff upper lip business. It's their way for sure. But he knows what I ordered him to do, and he's not likely to forget that. And no matter what kind of foolishness you or anyone else wants to toss around about the Brits, there's nobody on this earth I'd rather have next to me in a foxhole.
Hagaru Ree, November 29th, 10:30 p.m. He sat alone, enjoying the pipe, another letter to Esther forming itself in his mind.
You'll read about this one, I'm afraid. I had no choice. No one ever wants to hear that excuse, but it's what I believe. There have been decisions made by others handed to me this entire campaign, most of them incredible, ridiculous. This one was mine. Did I truly believe we could open that road, that the Chinese weren't as strong there, or that they might just back away? Someone will ask those questions one day. Drysdale is asking them right now, as he wonders if he's going to lose his arm. The outer door burst open, the guard making way for the wrapped bundle of a man, another behind him. Smith couldn't avoid a nagging dread, wrapped the pipe against the chair, stuffed it in his pocket. He waited, saw Bowser's head emerge from the coat, the man red-faced, out of breath. The aide waiting for Bowser to remove the coat.
Have you two been out doing maneuvers in this cold, Colonel?
Bowser kept the coat on, was breathing heavily still, tore through a pocket, pulled out a piece of paper.
Sir, this is momentous. Finally, somebody up there is thinking straight.
Up there? Heaven? Bowser seemed to miss the joke, said, "Tokyo, sir. MacArthur's HQ. This just came through from 10th Corps. Shall I read it?" Smith could see Bowser's excitement.
"Give it here. You might rip it to pieces."
Smith took the paper, felt the cold on the man and the paper, moved to a lantern. "Effective at once. All elements, 7th Infantry Division, are attached to 1st Marine Division. 1st Marine Division, redeploy one regiment without delay from Udomni area to Hagaru Ri area. Gain contact with elements of 7th Infantry Division east of Chosin Reservoir. Coordinate all forces in and north of Hagaru Ri in a defense based on Hagaru Ri. Open and secure Hagaru Ri and Koto Ri main supply road." Bowser waited impatiently, said, "Does that mean what it sounds like it means?" Smith lowered the paper, absorbed the order.
"Someone has determined that they require a single command to dig 10th Corps out of its hole."
"MacArthur, you think?"
Smith shrugged. "Doesn't matter, does it? I've been handed the results of someone else's idiotic decisions. There's still a finger stirring the pot, though. The middle section. Ahmond is ordering that we rescue the army units. He also insists we return at least one of our regiments from Udomni. I would assume he will allow us to do the latter before the former. We have no one here now we can spare to go driving up the east side of the reservoir. The army's own tanks can't push through. I'm not going to tell Colonel Drysdale that the next duty for his Marines might be the most hopeless task we face."
Bowser seemed frustrated, pointed to the paper.
"Sir, they've given you command of the entire situation, 7th Division included, the whole show."
"Careful, Alpha. Read between the lines. Yes, I am now in command of those troops who, from all we can determine, are presently surrounded by overwhelming numbers of Chinese forces. The most obvious conclusion here is that General Ahmond has had his mind changed about pushing us on to the Yalu. He can't figure out what to do next, so he's tossing it to me."
Bowser smiled now.
"I'm sorry, sir, but that seems to me to be a positive thing."
Smith had the sudden aching need for a cup of coffee, looked out to the waiting aide.
"Sergeant, there's a coffee pot in that corner. Will you do what you can to put it to work?"
"Certainly, sir." Smith sat again, stared at the covered window, could hear the wind rattling the glass.
"They haven't come yet, have they?"
"The enemy? No, sir. I can't help but wonder if this cold isn't killing them as efficiently as we are."
Smith shook his head. "No, they're coming. And now I can do what needs to be done. Send in one of the secretaries. I'm preparing orders for Murray and Litzenberg to make immediate preparations to extricate themselves from contact with the enemy at Udomni, to clear the road between Udomni and here. They have worked well together, and they can continue to do so."
The sergeant was there now, said, "Sir, I will fetch Corporal Hanley if you wish. He's good with a pencil."
Bowser motioned toward the door. "Then go fetch him."
The man moved out quickly, and Smith saw more enthusiasm from Bowser, the man's pulsating energy. Bowser starting to pace the room. Smith retrieved the pipe again, could hear the percolating of the coffee pot.
"It could all come down on us, Alpha."
Bowser still paced, seemed not to absorb what he was saying. He stopped now, looked at Smith.
"You mean a scapegoat?"
"Of course a scapegoat, or any other form of goat. Ahmond thinks he's handing me enough rope to hang with. It's our job to show the men out here, all of the men in this command, that this campaign is a success."
"I don't follow you, sir."
"I could care two hoots how Tokyo or 10th Corps judges us, but right now there are near 15,000 men out there in this cold who believe somebody's paying attention."
"You've always been paying attention, sir." Smith picked up the paper, held it up.
"Now I can do more than that. Now I can fix this thing."
Chapter 28.
Riley. Fox Hill, November 29th, 5 p.m.
This isn't a good situation, but I don't want to leave this ridge. If they can't knock us off here, I'm not handing it to 'em for free.
The others seemed to agree with the captain, Riley hanging close behind Welch, his eyes on Barber's crude crutches. They had gathered back behind the rocky ridge, mostly out of sight of the snipers across the saddle. The Chinese hadn't improved their marksmanship, but any gathering outside of the cover of the foxholes would invite more than just the single rifleman. The air cover had been effective, certainly, and Riley guessed, along with Welch, that in the daylight the Chinese would have one eye focused on the skies above them. But the airstrikes had not erased the threat. It was plainly obvious that when the Chinese lost any of their machine guns, it was very soon replaced with another. Late that afternoon, columns of fresh enemy troops had been spotted out to the west of 2nd Platoon on the hill across the road. It was an unusual tactic. Not much surprise to their assault, the Chinese coming out of the woods, attempting to cross the main road, driving up the hill nearer the aid stations. But Lieutenant Peterson, 2nd Platoon's commander, had observed the move along with his men, the columns of troops marching in full view down the draws on the west hill. When they made their strike, it began as it always had, bugles blaring, whistles blowing, but now the Marines were fully prepared. Line after line of Chinese soldiers emerged through the tree line, only to be cut down by the light and heavy machine guns, the BARs and rifles, of the men who saw it all coming. The fight lasted no more than a half hour, and to every observer on the hill, it seemed only to have been a one-sided slaughter. 2nd Platoon lost only a single man killed. The cold skies had grown cloudy late in the day, the ominous gathering of dense gray that most often resulted in a snowstorm. With darkness falling rapidly, Captain Barber had climbed up along the ridge, finding out for himself what his men already knew. With so many of the Marines hauled down to the aid stations, either wounded or frostbitten, the perimeter was beginning to stretch dangerously thin. Riley could see the weakness in Barber's face, the man in just as much pain now as he had been at the aid station down the hill. Beside Barber was Lieutenant Wright, his executive officer. Riley didn't know the man at all, but, like the others around him, wondered just how long Barber could keep up the effort he was making to maintain control, whether or not Wright would end up taking command of the company. Riley could see Wright's concern, shared it himself, Barber's limp more severe each time he moved along the hillside. But for now, Barber was still in charge.
"I'm not sure what they're up to, but you can bet they'll come back tonight. I don't have the first idea what they thought they were trying to prove in front of 2nd Platoon, but they stayed off that damn saddle all day. Thank the Corsairs for that." He looked at Goolsby. "Spread 'em out. Put a man in every hole, full alert. It's the best we can do."
Barber paused, seemed to gather himself, finding the energy. He scanned the faces, said,
"I had relatives fought with Robert E. Lee at Petersburg. Grant starved him out and broke his army. That's what we got here, a full-out siege. The enemy believes he's going to accomplish the same thing, but Lee didn't have flying boxcars dropping ammo to his troops. Right now, ammo is more important than rations. As long as the air boys can keep delivering, we'll keep killing Chinese. Maybe Chairman Mao will figure out that penning us up in a slaughter pen wasn't such a good idea."
Goolsby glanced at the few sergeants close by, most of them keeping a discreet distance.
"Sir, how long do you think we've got to stay up here?"
Riley saw the frown on Barber's face.
"Son, if I knew that, I'd be a general. Maybe a Chinese general. We'll stay here until we don't have to anymore. Clear?"
"Yes, sir."
Barber glanced at Welch, seemed relieved there was a veteran on the ridge.
"Go to work. Gather up what you can from the corpses. Both sides. If you see a weapon that works, the Chinese are just as liable to pick it up as you are. Grenades, anything else. I'm heading over to 1st Platoon.
Lieutenant Dunn is about the only officer on this hill who hasn't been hit. All right, go to work.
Barber hobbled off, Wright and a pair of aides following. Goolsby looked around, his focus now on Welch.
You heard him, Sergeant. I think you should man that machine gun again.
I'll take Riley, sir. I need a loader.
Goolsby nodded. Fine, but make a quick check down the hills. Search the bodies again.
You heard the captain. Pick up as many grenades as you can find. I'd just as soon avoid what happened to me yesterday.
The more you can toss down the hill, the fewer will get tossed back at you.
Or me.
Welch motioned to Riley, moved off toward the gun. The others scattered as well, and Riley heard the ping off a nearby rock, a sniper taking aim, the men quickening their steps. Welch, knelt by the machine gun, worked the action, said,
Not too bad. The cold doesn't seem to bother this thing as much as the carbines. We heat it up a bit. It'll work even better. Check those boxes, full ones first.
Riley knelt, opened the heavy steel boxes, part of the load dropped by the first cargo plane.
We're good. Three full plus some. You want to do a test fire?
Hell no. I'm not sure they've spotted this gun yet, and there's no need to help them out while it's daylight. They show up tonight, we'll have plenty of time to test everything we got. How many grenades you got?
Riley felt through his coat. Four?
Not enough. Let's head down the hill before it's full dark. Plenty of chinks we ain't really gotten to yet.
You going with me?
Welch laughed.
Yeah, sissy boy. I'm not about to turn you loose again. You might end up in Peking. There ain't nothing about a chink POW camp that sounds like a place I want to spend my vacation.
Welch looked out to the side.
Hang on. I'm going to make sure Kane and the others know we're out there. It ain't dark, but it's getting there. And that kid loves to shoot up all his ammo. And don't forget, damn it, you see any steam coming out of any of these chink bastards, it means they're alive. Blow 'em to hell.
Welch motioned him out, and Riley followed. Slipped along the gentle slope, past the first of the white-clad bodies. He had learned what to look for. The grenade carriers, usually unarmed, carrying a cloth sack. Most of the men closer to the machine gun had been picked over, their odd assortment of rifles now adding to the store of arms along the ridge. Welch pointed toward the thicket, farther down, where Riley had confronted the enemy soldiers. He felt uneasy, didn't really want to see that place again, but Welch was waiting for him. The look that said, Move it. Welch bent low, shoved at one of the bodies, picked up a Thompson, a nodding smile toward him.
Yeah, fine, Riley thought. It's a treasure hunt.
Welch was stuffing something else in his coat pocket, and Riley began to search the ground himself, closer to the deep thicket, stopped at the man he had briefly captured. The man's chest was ripped open, and Riley stared at the pool of frozen blood, an odd pink color. Saw now the neat hole in the man's head where Morelli had finished the job.
Didn't need a prisoner anyway, he thought. What the hell would I have done with him?
He heard Welch whispering to him. Looked up, Welch holding a cloth bag.
Magazines for the Thompson. Look here. Still says U.S. Army on the bag.
Lucky you. Now I ain't got to buy you a Christmas present.
Riley scanned more of the bodies. Saw the corner of a cloth bag just visible beneath a man's shoulder.
Oh, God, he thought. Here we go.
He reached down, a hard grip on the quilted coat, pulled, then harder, the body unmoving, frozen to the hard ground.
Guess you can keep it, buddy.
He looked toward the next body, heard an odd grunt, saw Welch, dropped down. He heard the impact now. A string of machine gun slugs skittering on the hard ground. He fell flat, another burst spraying closer by, some impacting the body beside him. He kept his face to the ground, waited for a pause in the fire, and Welch shouted,
Up! Now! He's reloading! Up the hill!
Welch scampered past him, Riley rising, a hard scramble to keep up. He was above the brush, in the open, the rocks in front of him, and now the machine gun opened again. Stitching the ground to one side. He kept moving, a fast run, Welch faster still,
A leap into the tall rocks. Riley jumped into cover. A hard landing, sore bones on frozen earth. He heard laughter somewhere close, lay flat, gasping through the frigid air, the laughter continuing. Welch was flat beside him, still had the Thompson, his breathing in sharp gasps as well. Riley said, "Who's laughing?"
"Who do you think?"
Riley sat up, looked to one side, up on the ridgeline, saw Kane, the crew of the BAR, faces above the rim of their foxholes.
"You know, they got the Olympics in a couple of years. You two ought to run a relay."
More laughter came now, all along the hill, Riley leaning his back against the tall rock. "They can go down there next time." Welch pulled himself up, one arm lying across the breech of the machine gun.
"Bastard thinks he's Milton Berle."
Riley couldn't help a smile, said, "At least you got another Thompson. How many's that?" Welch moved a white blanket aside, another prize from the fallen Chinese.
"This makes four.
You think I might get to use one?" Welch seemed to ponder the question.
"Well, hell, I found a bag of ammo for him. Guess it can't hurt."
Riley took the Thompson from Welch, felt the heft. "Always heard these things were pretty useless. No range."
"How much range do you think you need? We're not sharpshooters, you know." "You don't want it. Give it back."
Riley thought of the night before, then before that, the hordes of Chinese, the fight on all sides. "Hand me some of those clips." Fox Hill, November 30th, 1 a.m. The supply plane had come again, the big C-119 boxcar, unloading massive pallets of materiel under white parachutes. It had been nearly dark, the men on one part of the hill following Barber's orders to gather in a circle, each one aiming a flashlight skyward. But the pilot hadn't the aim of the first one, ground fire from the Chinese on the rocky hill keeping the plane much higher than it needed to be. The result was a missed target, many of the pallets falling well down the hill, nearly 300 yards beyond the perimeter. It was as much a gift to the Chinese as it was to the disgusted men on Fox Hill. The rescue had begun immediately, before the Chinese could fully grasp what a bounty they might have received. The journey down into the wooded draw was dangerous, to be sure, but Barber pushed the men to move quickly, and well after dark most of the supplies were hauled back where they belonged. As if the pilot's inaccuracy weren't cause enough for annoyance, one of the pallets was loaded with what someone to the south must have thought was a precious necessity for the suffering Marines, cans of fresh water. By the time the water was discovered, it had passed beyond usefulness. It was solid ice. By midnight, the Chinese began to open up their machine guns across the saddle, sprays of green tracers peppering the crest of the hill, where the Chinese gunners had ranged their guns throughout the daylight hours. The mortars came as well, not as accurate, impacting in scattered patterns that weren't patterns at all. The Marines kept mostly to their foxholes, accepting that this latest assault was surely the preliminary of yet another massed attack by the Chinese infantry. Riley sat low in the foxhole just behind the machine gun, his sleeping bag again wrapping his legs. It was the first time he had shared cover with Welch in a very long time. Another war, another part of the world. There was no talk, the noise from the mortar and machine gun barrage driving each man's thoughts inside. Riley knew there could be no sleep, the captain's orders clear. But the barrage was hypnotic, and Riley felt himself drifting off, soothed by the steady chatter and rumbles of the Chinese fire. He thought of Ruthie and the boy, meeting him at a plane, Philadelphia, maybe. "She'll dress like a goddess," he thought. "She loves that. Standing out in a crowd. And boy, does she. She'll try to be the first thing I see when I come off the plane. Or the train. Hell, I don't know. Maybe they'll let me drive home in a jeep, just pull up to the front yard and beep the damn horn.
Hi, honey. I'm home. Let me tell you about my day at the office.
And Peter, so happy to see his old man. He had a jolting thought. What if he doesn't remember who the hell I am?
God, no. Can't have that. Need to write her, tell her to show him pictures every day. Please don't let him forget. And if I don't come home, well, do that anyway.
He sat up, wiped at the crusty goo around his eyes. Enough of that for crying out loud. He looked at Welch, the sergeant's voice rising above the din of the firing.
You fall asleep?
No, thinking of home. Bad idea.
Writing a few letters myself. Wonder when we'll get to mail 'em.
A mortar shell impacted a few feet in front of the hole, and Riley flinched, pulled his head down like a turtle. Too close, he thought. Welch said,
They adjust that one a couple notches, and we won't have to worry about it. Should have dragged more of those Chinese sandbags up here. We'll do that tomorrow.
There was commotion behind the rocks, and Riley heard voices, eased up slowly, a lull in the mortar fire. There were two men hauling a stretcher, the wounded man suddenly rising up, sitting, the men lowering him to the ground. It was Captain Barber.
All right, I've had about enough of this. I've ordered the spotter, Lieutenant Campbell, to call back to Hogaroo Ree and give us some of that artillery support they say we have. O'Leary's waiting for word from Campbell to fire some star shells so we can range the incoming fire. Sergeant?
Riley saw another man crawling up closer, a field telephone wrapped around the man's shoulder.
Yes, sir, I'm set.
Riley was curious, watched the two stretcher bearers, huddled low now, Barber pushing out, lying flat on the ground.
Give me the damn phone. Who's this? Campbell? What did they say?
Barbara listened for a long moment, said,
Tell Captain Reed we're ready.
He listened again, then said aloud,
All right, listen up. Four artillery rounds coming in. Wait for it.
Riley couldn't help peering up, his eyes just above the rim of the hole, staring out toward the saddle. The machine gun fire was relentless from the rocky hill, another spray chewing up rocks down below. The mortar shells erupted over the knoll now, sunlight in the darkness, the star shells drifting lower, the distant rocks bathed in a blinding light. Now the artillery shells came in, sharp slices through the night air, the knoll erupting in four distinct blasts. Riley stared, could see men blown airborne, rocks and equipment blown into pieces. The star shells faded to darkness now. The fiery impacts from the 105 shells passing. Behind him, Barber said,
I'll be a son of a bitch.
He was on the phone again, said,
Wonderful! Perfect! Cease fire! Targets destroyed!
There was a silent moment, and Barber laughed now.
You heard me! Targets destroyed! Tell that captain I owe him a cigar.
Riley watched the scene, realized now the barrage had stopped. Welch was up beside him, staring out, said,
What the hell? They hit it the first time?
He turned to Barber now, who sat staring out at the same dark space.
I guess that was some fine shooting, eh, sir?
Barber said, an announcement to the entire platoon,
That was Howe Company, 11th Marines. Those boys are in Hogaroo Ree, 7 miles from here. I had hoped they might zero in on those enemy guns after maybe a half dozen attempts. I was also hoping they didn't blow us to hell in the process. I need to have more faith. Eyes front, boys. The enemy's still coming, but there's a few less machine guns out there to lead the way.
Riley looked again to the front, silent darkness, heard the captain give a subtle order, the stretcher bearers loading him up once more. They moved off, back down the hillside. And Riley said, He's in rough shape. Would have walked up here if he could. Welch adjusted the assortment of weapons in front of him, said,
Yep. Hate to see him go down. Hope the damn doctor pays attention to whatever his wound's doing. I guess he's not such a jerk after all.
There, to the right of the saddle.
Riley followed Welch's point, saw the column of white filing out quickly from the deep draw.
God, Hemp, there's a million of them.
Welch was out of the hole, slid in behind the machine gun, said,
Shut up and handle the ammo.
Welch worked the action on the 30 caliber, the belt in place, and Riley ignored the M1, gripped the Thompson. Down below, the hillside was covered with a fresh blanket of snow several inches deep, the Chinese soldiers standing out plainly against the newly clean background. Riley felt the thunder in his chest, watched the enemy spreading out their lines off to the right toward the deep thicket. He felt the terror rising up, the uncontrollable panic, his hand shaking, a painful grip on the Thompson. To one side, a voice, Goolsby, make ready to repel boarders. Welch laughed, surprising Riley, the laughter contagious. Welch shook his head, shouted,
Aye, aye, sir.
Riley kept his eyes on the Chinese, Goolsby's ridiculous order bringing thoughts of sailing ships and pirates, a celebrated history, part of the lore of the Corps. To the shores of Tripoli. Welch fired the machine gun now, jarring him, and he put one hand on the first box of ammo, watching Welch. Both men huddled low. The machine gun spit out in brief bursts, a two-second pause between, then another burst. Now Welch fired in a long, continuous stream, sweeping the ground in front, taking his toll on the advance of the enemy. When the gun was empty, Riley fed the next belt, dragging another up close. All along the hill, the Marines responded to the Chinese advance, their mortars from the backside of the hill dropping a steady rain of explosive horror all along the enemy's lines. For the Chinese, nothing had changed. The grenade carriers moving up first, struggling to draw close enough to toss their one weapon, the Marine rifles, machine guns, and mortar shells wiping them away. Behind the grenadiers, the riflemen pushed forward, walking obediently into the bloody carnage, taking aim at the Marines, who took aim at them. Then the third line moved up, men with heavier weapons, the Russian burp guns and American Thompsons, stepping past so many who had already gone down. The breakthroughs were minor and short-lived, the Marines now too familiar with the methods of their enemy. For the next couple of hours, the Chinese continued to press while the Marines, fully stocked with a fresh supply of ammunition and arms, mostly held them away. With the approach of the dawn, the Chinese effort lost energy, the continuing advances more feeble, until finally they pulled back altogether. Across the hillside, the fresh blanket of powdery snow was again spread with the remains of the men who had been sent up the hill to drive the Americans away. For the Chinese soldiers, the effort had been as costly as any before, and still they came, following orders passed down to them from far up their chain of command. The orders reflected the desperate importance of their mission to eliminate the Marines who held this hill, opening the way for a stout Chinese roadblock at the most effective choke point south of Udomni, the winding, narrow passage through Toktong Pass. After 3 nights of massed assaults, both sides had been bloodied, but the Chinese had absorbed astonishing losses against an enemy they outnumbered by better than 12-1. On November 30th, with daylight breaking on another brutally frigid morning, the Chinese could only regroup yet again and watch from their hidden places as the Marines made ready to receive another attack, firmly entrenched on their solitary hill.
Chapter 29. Sung. North of Udomni, November 30th, 1950, 9 a.m. The hospital was set among a thick grove of trees, a small run-down house, the occupant abandoning it to the Chinese. He came to inspire the men, one of those duties a commander should exercise, whether or not he hated the task. There was no heat, the risk of a smoky fire too great, the American fighters patrolling the area all through the day. He stood just inside, grateful the cold kept the smells away, watched the doctor working on a soldier, a bloodless operation, removing the man's fingers. Sung didn't really want to know why, but there were others, hands wrapped in fat bandages, sitting on the floor of the house, huddled together beneath a number of white blankets. The doctor completed the task, an aide handling the bandages, the patient seemingly unconscious. Sung was grateful for that, had heard too much screaming from these places. It was one advantage of the cold that many of the soldiers were brought here nearly frozen, halting the flow of blood from so many wounds. The doctor wiped at his hands, red and raw, stuffing them into his shirt now, a feeble effort to bring warmth to his fingers. Sung waited, had no reason to hurry the doctor, did not require that mindless salute that so many of the officers seemed to enjoy, an exercise of their own power. The doctor turned toward him now, seemed surprised, but his reaction was dampened by his own shivering.
"General, welcome. I would offer you tea, but there is none."
The man was young, Sung guessed 25, too young for what he was experiencing now. Sung had no idea what his medical qualifications were, knew only that he had come attached to the 124th Division, along with a handful of others. The hospitals were scattered, as close to the fighting as the commanders dared. Unlike the Americans, the Chinese ignored the Red Cross insignias, assuming that the Americans in their planes would ignore them as well. Sung agreed with his officers that it was far better to camouflage the makeshift hospitals, just as they hid any kind of supply dump.
"I do not require tea, doctor."
He looked past the man, the patient being moved carefully toward the gathering of men, all with the same bandages.
"Tell me, doctor, are those men all carrying the same wounds? They are bandaged alike."
The doctor rubbed his hands against his sides, still inside his coat.
"They are not wounds, precisely, sir. These men are like so many others. They were found nearly unconscious, their hands frozen to the steel of their weapons. There is no remedy but to sever their fingers. I suppose the military prefers men to remain loyal to their rifles, no matter the conditions. Their digits are still attached to their weapons, if that pleases you."
Sung looked again at the men seated beneath the blankets, the newest patient set down among them. He would forgive the doctor for his impudence, had no reason to find fault with any man who did this kind of work.
"I am not pleased at all, doctor. Is this a common problem?"
The doctor shrugged.
"It is common enough. The men are suffering more from the cold than they are from wounds. A great many have lost use of their feet. Fortunately, most of those men have died as a result."
Sung looked at the man now, trying to read him.
"Why is that fortunate? Bitterness is not a virtue here, doctor. You will not speak to me in such a tone."
The threat was empty, both men aware that Sung would do nothing to remove any doctor from his work.
"I mean no disrespect, General. I do not enjoy my work. No matter that this is a duty I must perform. Perhaps it will please you that these men are ready to begin their journey. I can do no more for them here. They have feet. They can walk."
There was a hint of anger in the man's words, and Sung tried to ignore that as well, his eyes on the men.
"Good. We must wait until dark and send them north. Do they understand? They have surrendered to the inevitable, sir. Is that not what good soldiers must do? They have not died today, and so they will likely die tomorrow."
Sung pulled the coat more tightly around him, his hands stuffed in the fur-lined pockets.
"Doctor, there is no argument, and there is no alternative. They will die here because we cannot feed them. We cannot warm them. If they march north, they have a chance of reaching the Yalu and assistance. I have ordered that patrols advance south of the river to rendezvous with these men. There are many others in the same situation, Doctor. It is the only course we have. I need every man here to be fit and capable of fighting. Any man who cannot fight only consumes supplies.
The doctor would not look at him, stared downward.
I understand, sir. It is mathematics.
Sung was impatient now.
Call it what you wish, Doctor. I admire you for doing your duty here in these conditions. I do not ask that you admire me for doing mine, but I will do what I must. I do not have the luxury of a conscience.
North of Udomni, November 30th, 11 a.m.
In view of our many advantages thus far, I am confident that our mission will be gloriously successful. We enjoy a significant superiority in manpower, which we are using to counter the enemy's air forces and long-range artillery. It would be premature to offer the Central Committee a specific timetable for our victory. However, we are engaging the enemy on several fronts, and we hold the advantage in every position. We offer our most sincere congratulations to General Lin Biao for the victories he has enjoyed.
He stopped, thought, yes, offering that kind of praise is a wise move. Lin is continuing to drive the enemy southward, and I must not show envy for his success. His enemy, no doubt, is a weaker foe than what we are facing here. The aide waited, paper in hand, and Sung stood now, said,
I believe that will be adequate. Chairman Mao has not expressed disappointment with our efforts here. There is no need to thicken my report with empty promises. Put my words to ink and bring it to me for my signature. You may leave.
The aide rose, a quick bow, left the small house. Sung continued to stand, staring out through a cracked window pane. To one side, his two primary aides kept to their chairs, no one speaking. He turned now, said,
I do not anticipate remaining in this place beyond today. We must move closer to our front lines. The troops require inspiration. Colonel Liu, bring me the map of the reservoir, the entire area.
Right away, sir.
Liu rose, left quickly, and Sung turned to the window again.
What do you think of my report, Colonel Wang?
Wang stood, always too formal, said stiffly,
Your message to the Central Committee is excellent, sir. Chairman Mao can only be pleased with our campaign. I see great advancement for you, sir, when our victory is secure.
Sung looked at the young man, said,
Did you rehearse your words again?
Wang showed surprise, shook his head, and Sung raised a hand.
No matter. I should appreciate that everyone around here agrees with me. The fact is, Colonel, our progress against the enemy is not adequate. Across the mountains, Lin Biao has driven the Americans and their allies far to the south, and I am quite confident that if they have not yet done so, they will soon liberate Pyongyang. We have failed to drive the Americans back more than a mile. Our strategy has been sound, and by our maneuvers we created excellent opportunity. And yet the victory Peking expects of us has been slow in coming.
Sir, we are in control of the field in every quarter. Your tactics have prevailed. The enemy is entrapped and cannot survive as he stands now.
Sung stared at the young man.
How do you know that? How does he stand now?
Wang seemed uncertain, said,
You have said yourself, sir, we have encircled the Americans in every place they fight us. If they do not die from our guns, they will starve or freeze.
Sung turned to the window again.
You are quoting me again, Colonel. I said those very words 2 days ago, and probably the day before that.
I believed you then, sir. I believe you now.
As you said to Peking, our advantages will bring us victory in short order.
Sung kept his gaze outside, the flurries of snow brushing silently against the window.
How many men have we lost to the cold?
I am not completely certain, sir. If you wish, I shall order Captain Jin to prepare a report.
I don't need a report, Colonel. I visited the hospitals myself. My orders are being carried out even now. Any man who cannot fight but who can walk will march northward. We cannot continue to feed men who cannot fight.
Wang lowered his voice, as though the small house had an audience.
I had not thought it would become necessary. Is there no transportation for them?
Sung turned to him, angrier now.
No, Colonel, there is not. How would you handle this? We are unable to bring supply convoys south. The enemy has destroyed the bridges over the Yalu and continues to intercept any vehicles that show themselves on the roads. So yes, we can move at night. But now there are no adequate supplies of gasoline and spare parts for the few trucks that still operate. Even if we had gasoline, we cannot overcome the cold. Batteries and lubricants do not function in this weather, Colonel. In this part of Korea, there are no supplies of rice or meat for this army to gather, no bounty to be found on farms in these hills. The North Koreans are useless. They despise us as deeply as they despise the Americans.
He paused, tried not to be angry at his aide.
Our weapons are no match for what the Americans bring to the fight. Every soldier knows the challenges of fighting an offensive campaign. The Americans fight on the defensive, from holes in the ground, and we have no artillery to drive them out. How many more men must we send into their guns before we exhaust him? I have seen his cargo planes, Colonel. They drop endless supplies of everything he needs to continue the fight. Here, we are running out of every kind of supply.
He stopped, angry at himself, his heart pounding, short, heavy breaths. I do not need to speak this way, he thought. My superiors would not approve. Wang seemed to wait for an opening, said,
We still have great advantage in numbers, sir. As you said to Peking, what I said to Peking is what Peking requires me to say. They do not entertain reports of our discomfort. They will not hear of our problems. There is no counsel for me, Colonel. No one can offer me advice. I have been granted this position, and I will succeed, or I will be removed. I am not yet willing to accept that outcome.
Colonel Liu returned now, a gust of icy wind chasing him through the door. He moved quickly, shivering, spread the map out on the lone table. Sung stepped that way, heard a light rap from outside the door. Liu said,
My apologies, General. Major Orloff requested to know what I was bringing you. I was told not to keep any information from him.
Sung looked toward the door, the anger draining away his energy.
Bring the Major inside. I do not need him suffering in this cold any more than the rest of us. Our situation is plain for all to see, even the Soviets.
Liu moved to the door, Orlov moving inside quickly, his fur coat dusted with snow.
Ah, General, fine morning. No colder than usual, if you are camped at the South Pole. I understand you are in need of some counsel, advice, perhaps. I am always at your service.
Sung had long accepted that Orlov seemed capable of reading minds.
Major, what I require is wisdom. I am confronting an enemy who has proven far more stubborn than I expected. What, may I ask, did you expect?
Orlov shed the fur coat, laid it on one of the small chairs. He rubbed his hands together, moved to the map, scanned the details. Sung was used to the man's theatrics, could feel the drama playing out. After a long moment, Orlov said,
I read over your report to Peking. You are most optimistic. I applaud you.
Sung closed his eyes for a brief moment, thought, no secrets indeed.
I spoke the truth. Chairman Mao expects nothing less.
Orlov looked at him, winked.
He demands nothing less. I am quite certain that General Lin's reports are magnificent. Victory upon victory. An enemy who flees before his sword. All very romantic stuff, yes? He is fortunate to have drawn the card he has.
What card? What do you mean?
I mean that the Eighth Army Lin Biao has been successful against is a United Nations force, a combination of commands, a mongrel army, if you will. You, however, are fighting a monolith. Every general in the last war, and the one before that, preferred to fight an enemy of many nations, many cultures. Napoleon said he always preferred fighting allies.
Are you suggesting that because we are engaged with only the Americans, we are at a disadvantage?
Aren't you? Look at these Marines who are giving you such trouble. They are trained as a single force. They fight for a single commanding general. They are supported by their own artillery units, and most often, they are supported by their own fighter planes. Is there any place on this map where you have driven the Marines off the ground they have chosen to defend?
Sung felt himself sagging, looked at the two staff officers, said,
Leave us.
Both men hesitated, but Sung gave each a hard stare. The message understood. They moved out, the door clattering behind them. Orlov moved to a chair, sat heavily.
General Sung, I am telling you what you already know. Your staff knows it as well. Your army knows it. It is your choice, of course, to keep Peking from knowing it. A wise precaution, to be sure.
What is it that I know so well, that is so obvious to everyone here?
You will not defeat these Marines with the tactics you are now using. There is a better way. There is always a better way when one is being defeated.
Sung felt the anger returning.
Defeated? You will not insult me, Major, with your speculations. We control every piece of ground. We have the enemy trapped, encircled, and in short order he will either die or surrender. It is only a matter of time. I thought you were here to observe so that you might convince your superiors to give us more weapons. Instead, I hear meaningless lectures. Rather than offer such pessimism, perhaps you can find me a battery of anti-aircraft guns, yes? Would your chairman Stalin be so generous?
Orlov raised both arms out to the side.
No anti-aircraft guns with me today. Sorry. Perhaps next week.
He smiled now.
General, I am not your enemy. Yes, I observe. I see difficulties for you. You are losing men at a drastic rate, either to bullets or frostbite. Or is that merely speculation?
No one in this army dares speak to me as you do. I tolerate it because I must.
Are you better off by surrounding yourself with those so eager to please that they would only bow down to you or speak soft compliments for all you do here? Are you helped by having officers who believe what you tell Peking, even as their men die by the score?
You offer the obvious, Major. I am doing what I can to inflict greater damage on the enemy. He cannot survive this much longer.
Can you?
Sung felt his hands curl into tight fists, closed his eyes. He tried to calm himself, said,
If there is nothing else you wish to say, I must end this conversation. I must communicate with my commanders. We must make ready to continue our assaults against Hagaru Ri. Even now, we are pushing the enemy inward.
Again?
Yes, again. The Marines there are weak, undermanned. It is the most important target.
Yes, yes. So, why would this assault be different than any before? You left a considerable number of casualties there. Do you anticipate a change from that?
Orlov stood, moved closer to the map. "General, you have not even been able to drive a single company of Marines from Tok Tong Pass. How many casualties have you left out there? How many more are spread over the ground around Yudamni?"
"It is war, Major. Can you advise me where there might be an enemy who is unarmed?"
Orlov looked at the map, a finger pointing down.
"East of the reservoir. One battalion of the American 7th Infantry Division. They are surrounded, except for their one flank that rests on the reservoir itself."
"I am aware of that. Am I to be impressed you can read a map? We have already engaged those troops. It would seem your analysis of the enemy here is not correct after all. Those troops are very different from the Marines, an entirely different command."
Orlov kept a smile.
"Yes, they are, at least for now. General MacArthur's people in Tokyo are extremely concerned about those troops. It seems they climbed out a bit far on their limb. No fault of their field officers. It was orders, you know. Just like the American 8th Army, those people who now flee from General Lin, this lone battalion was terribly excited about participating in a race to reach the Yalu River. The Americans do like their competitions. Now they are in something of a bind, wouldn't you say?"
Sung wanted to ask yet again, "How do you know these things?" But he knew that Orlov would evade him again, as he had so many times before.
"If you wish me to be impressed, Major, very well, I am. One day we shall have to discuss Soviet intelligence and your skill at communications."
"One day."
Orlov focused again on the map.
"General, I understand your frustration. You may treat me with disrespect if it helps you, but I am not your problem. I am here to observe, as you said."
Sung felt a helplessness, could not deny that Orlov had a firm grasp on the entire campaign.
"Major, are you suggesting it is a mistake to attempt another assault on Hagaru Ri?"
"I am suggesting that you not make the same assault. You have faced supreme stubbornness at Yudamni, at Tok Tong Pass, at Kotori, and at Hagaru Ri. Your primary mission is to destroy the enemy. Why not give your army some red meat?"
"What do you mean?"
"They are hungry for a victory, so give them the best chance they might have. The army battalion is not as well trained as the Marines. Their artillery is not as strong. If you crush the Americans east of the reservoir, you will have an open door to strike at Hagaru Ri from three directions. You have two full divisions facing those army troops, yes?"
"The 79th and 80th, yes. Another in reserve."
"I doubt you will require your reserves."
"Do I simply ignore the Marines at Yudamni, at Tok Tong Pass?"
Orlov shrugged. "Why not? You have them boxed in, so it is unlikely they are going anywhere. And this weather is your ally. Every day they sit in their foxholes, they die just a bit more."
"As do we, Major. My men are from a part of China that does not feel this kind of cold."
"And yet you would make them walk home?" Sung felt a wave of frustration again.
"What am I to do? I need every man to be capable. I have limited food, limited supplies of every kind, including ammunition. If they march toward China, there is hope for them. Patrols from the border will be sent south, assisting them. I have ordered it."
Orlov looked down, seemed to absorb the horror of what Sung was explaining to him.
"I do not envy you that responsibility, General. I would only advise that you complete your primary mission, that you destroy the enemy with all haste."
Sung turned away, moved again to the window, saw a thicket of small trees buffeted by the wind. His eye was caught by a photograph on the wall, unusual, a Korean family, dressed in city clothes.
"Look how they smile. a family outing, an adventure, perhaps to Pyongyang, a happier time. They did not bring this war, and we are here to liberate them, yet they only fear us.
Yes, I saw the photograph. Charming. General, you are using that man's home as your headquarters. Your soldiers are spread out in whatever tiny kingdom that man's family holds dear. If he had any food or livestock, you have taken it. If he protests to you, very likely your officers would harm him or his family. He has fled because he has no choice. It is no different here than it was in Russia. If you care so much, then do what you must to end this. Perhaps then your pleasant reports to Peking will be accurate, a victory that will provide you a triumphant return, bathing you in the glory of the revolution.
Sung looked at him. You are mocking me, Major.
I am mocking us all. If you do not succeed here, your career will end in disgrace, a deadly outcome, yes? If you do succeed, they will find one more command for you, another war, another foe, until you fail or die. I have always wondered which is better, dying for your revolution or dying as an old man in some hospital.
The revolution, of course.
That's what they expect us both to believe, certainly. Either way, you're just as dead.
He saw a crack in the Major's arrogance. A surprise.
We have no alternative, Major. It is the path we have chosen. It is the path assigned to us.
Then choose your next move wisely, General. I can promise you your enemies are making their choices as well. And regardless of what you tell Peking, it is their stubbornness that is winning this fight.
Chapter 30. Smith. Hagaru Ri, North Korea, November 30th, 1950, 11 a.m. He absorbed their desperation, understood their urgency, could feel the sadness infecting both men now, the inevitability of what could become a disaster. Their anxiety was contagious, the kind of helplessness no commanding officer hoped to feel.
I am truly sorry, gentlemen, but I anticipate another assault tonight, and as you have seen, we are only secured here by a thin line. The fight for the East Hill has been ongoing and costly, though I am pleased to say that we have taken a hard toll on the enemy.
He regretted the words, thought, it's not the time for boasting, not even about that. The two men sat glumly, a glance between them. It was Barr who spoke first, the senior man offering Smith a painful smile.
General, we appreciate all you are doing here, all you have done throughout this campaign. General Hodes and I both were pleased when General Almond appointed you to overall command here. It certainly made sense. I had thought, forgive me, I had hoped that events